It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we take a look at the meal that identifies America to the world, the fast food burger, fries, and Coke. We talk to a man who believes the fast food industry should be examined with the same scrutiny we apply to tobacco and drug companies. Eric Schlosser is the author of Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. Our slow food junkies, Jane and Michael Stern, are eating apple dumplings in Charleston, West Virginia. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins picks the best American cheddars. Then the movie Chocolat has inspired a conversation on food in film. And I've got a TV tray menu for watching the Academy Awards. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure. A practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, I want to talk about the one vegetable most people can't cook without. The onion. Now, even if you don't cook, I guarantee most of what you eat tastes better because of the onion. From spaghetti sauces to salads to stir fries, just about everything needs onion for character, savoriness, and just plain good taste. But before cooking, we've got to choose our onion. There are over 300 different kinds of onions, each with different flavors. But most break down into a handful of categories. Yellow onions, red onions, white onions, scallions, shallots, leeks, garlic, and ramps, which taste like wild, untamed leeks. By the way, all onions are part of the lily family. The strength and flavor of an onion depends on the type of onion, how it's grown, and how long it's been stored. Usually, the fresher the onion, the moister it is, and the more tears we shed. I usually use yellow, red, and whites more or less interchangeably. They're the workhorses. They keep for weeks in open baskets on the countertop, and they taste great in most recipes. I don't find red onions are really milder than yellows or whites. Now, if you want a really sweet onion, go for the ones that you can practically eat like an apple, like Vidalia, Walla Walla, and Maui. These are best raw, but remember, they're very fragile, so buy them and use them up quickly. Now, if you want an onion that's sharp and aggressive and great for cooking, keep an eye out for the Stuttgart. It's in season in the fall, and I love to cut it up in large pieces, sauté it with a little bacon and lots of black pepper, and then finish it off with white wine vinegar for a hot onion salad. Onions are one of those vegetables that defend themselves against attack. Until you assault them, they're pretty benign. Sniff a whole onion. Nothing happens. But cut into one, and compounds and enzymes go to work. These substances combine with the moisture in your eyes to form sulfuric acid. The onion literally stings us. No, I do not have a solution for the tear problem. I've tried most of them, and the only one that works is sealed goggles. And I really think you can go too far in this area. Remember I said onions are defending themselves? Well, there are several ways to calm them down. You can tame an onion's aggressive strength by sprinkling it with some kind of acid or soaking it in ice water. Good tricks to know for raw onions and salads. And you can tame them by cooking. In fact, some slow sautéed onions can become sweeter than sugar. Now think about that for a moment. This is great stuff for we cooks to know. So many recipes begin with sautéing onions. Well, if you sauté them real slow, they get very sweet, almost like marmalade. And that sweetness can be the foundation of whatever you're making. If you want a meatier, more assertive and savory foundation, sauté the onions fast until they're flecked with brown. Now for onions is the main event. For Moroccan-style roasted onions, cut up a whole variety of them in big wedges. Then toss them with olive oil, lemon peel, olives, and lots of spices like cayenne and cumin and fennel. Roast them in a big shallow pan in a really hot oven until they're browned and tender. And then eat them with young sheep cheese and a crusty whole wheat bread. Then you can make a Scandinavian onion salad. Do a sweet sour dressing of vinegar, sugar, salt, pickling spices, and some water. Toss that with some sliced onions, marinate for a while, and then add fresh dill. We do an onion tomato stir fry for supper. We just stir fry lots and lots of ginger and garlic over high heat with a little bit of oil. Then we add wedges of onion and tomato. Stir fry for another few minutes. Add some sugar and salt, and then put that over some hot cooked rice. So take a new look at onions this week and join us for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials, nonstick hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Today we look at what's become the all-American meal, the fast food burger, fries, and a Coke. Our guest is Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. He's an award-winning journalist who writes for Atlantic Monthly and Rolling Stone. Schlosser's book has drawn a lot of notice and a lot of controversy. He believes the fast food industry should be examined with the same scrutiny we apply to tobacco and drug companies. Well, on the brighter side of the American food scene, we have cheese expert Steve Jenkins. He's a fan of our artisan cheesemakers. Today, he's going to tell us about American cheddar cheese. Steve thinks our cheddars are right up there with England's, and he names names. It's Academy Awards time, and we're talking with movie maven Stephanie Curtis about food in films. Now, if you've seen this year's foodie entry, Chocolat, you know that every time Juliette Binoche starts stirring that thick, dark, shiny chocolate, the audience starts to moan. Stephanie has her picks of the best and the worst examples of food in films, and I've got a special dinner menu to eat off the TV tray while you're watching the awards. Think Aaron Brockovich cooks for the Gladiator. Then we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get everything rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we've got a restaurant to tell you about today that has been open 24 hours a day, every day, since it opened in 1947.
I'm exhausted hearing about it.
We'll lie down on your couch and we'll continue to tell you about the Southern Kitchen in Charleston, West Virginia. I don't know what I like more about the Southern Kitchen, whether I like the ham and red eye gravy and biscuits, which is really one of their specialties, or Polly, Joyce, and Peggy, who are three blonde waitresses, all sisters, who work the dining room, and they are in the annals of great Southern women. I would put them at the top of the roster.
Well, we have to be honest. We have never met Peggy, because when the last time we were there, Polly and Joyce were working the dining room. Peggy was off. She had decided to go back to school. She was at truck driving school, learning to drive the big rig. So she may not return to the Southern Kitchen if she finds that truck driving suits her better.
Well, what's the food like?
Oh, it's real Southern food. I mean, as Jane said, the ham is not this blubbery city ham. It is country ham, like cured country ham with red-eye gravy, real warm biscuits, hot from the oven.
Do you know what red-eye gravy is, Lynn? I'm sure you must.
It's after you pan fry, and check me on this one. After you pan fry a slice of country ham, you throw some coffee
into the pan, and you kind of boil it down. You scrape up all the nubbins. Isn't that it?
Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah. We have often wondered how it got its name. We've heard all kinds of great explanations. My favorite is that fundamentally coffee and ham drippings do not mix. It's like oil and water. So that in a pitcher, red eye gravy, if it sits there for a while, if you look into the pitcher, it will look like a bloodshot eye. And that's how it got its name.
What an attractive concept this is.
That's why it's so popular everywhere.
Well, yes. Let's switch over to something that's a little more scenic or pretty to talk about. And that is the other specialty of the Southern kitchen, which is apple dumplings. They're a whole cored and peeled apple served in a homemade pastry crust. And they're served warm and with just wonderful cream or vanilla ice cream on the side. But Michael and I found this, I think, this terrific and unheralded combination, which is we ordered country ham and red-eye gravy, and then we ordered an apple dumpling, and we told them to hold the vanilla ice cream or the cream, and we had the apple dumpling with the country ham.
Ooh.
And doesn't that sound great?
Yeah, that really does.
Because the ham is very, very salty, and the dumpling is, you know, needless to say, this is the deep south, very sweet. And the crust on it, on the dumpling, was almost like having biscuits with the ham. So we kind of invented our own dish there. And I think it's the least that Polly, Joyce, and Peggy, the blonde waitresses at the Southern Kitchen, can do is to put our name on the menu.
They don't do that.
No, I guess. They only do that if you're a NASCAR driver.
Yeah.
In fact, NASCAR is a very major theme at the Southern Kitchen.
What does the place look like?
Well, in fact, I don't think there's a lot of room for anyone's picture on the wall of the Southern Kitchen because, in fact, Mrs. Hirschman, who has run the place since 1947, is a chicken maniac. And by this, I mean any figurine, picture, or drawing of a chicken she will get or acquire and put on the wall or a shelf of the place. So no matter where you look in the Southern Kitchen, there are chickens and chicken images everywhere.
And busts of chickens and breasts of chickens.
And egg baskets hanging from the ceiling.
Bas reliefs of chickens and hens and roosters and faux eggs in wire baskets hanging from the, you know. I mean, Michael, do they even serve chicken there?
Yes, they do. In fact, they have wonderful stewed chicken and dumplings. But we never get to that because we always go for that country ham and the apple dumpling.
You know, I think this is also one of those towns. I've been there. Good food and great people.
Great people.
Yeah.
I know you've been there because we've talked about Charleston, West Virginia, and both agreed that it is one of the great overlooked treasures as a little small town in America.
Well, now we
small
are
city in America.
Well, now we'll go in and ask for the Jane and Michael Stern special.
And get laughed out of the place.
Hey, guys, thanks.
Okay. Bye, Liv.
Bye, Liv. Chicken biscuit. Chicken
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. You can hear them here every week, and you can check out their road food finds anytime on our website, splendidtable.org. Cheese expert Steve Jenkins has been hunting down quality artisan cheese for over 20 years. He's the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer, and he oversees the cheese counters at the Fairway Markets in New York City. Steve stops by often to talk cheese. Hey, Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
Steve, I'd like to talk about American cheddar cheese. I always think of it as being sort of the old-time nobility of American cheeses.
Wow, that's well put, because it really is. You know, the first cows that walked down the gangplank of the first ship that the settlers brought to Jamestown were immediately milked because they were dying to be milked, and that milk was turned into cheddar. That was in 1649.
Well, do we have really great cheddars in the United States?
We have the most sublime cheddar in the entire universe. You have to understand about American cheddar. It's very different from Somerset cheddar, which is definitive. And I remind our listeners that cheddar, to cheddar, is a verb. When you make cheddar, it's a very specific process, different from any other cheese that's made, wherein the curds are piled up by hand into slabs and then laid physically on top of them over and over and over in order to drive out every bit of whey, which makes cheddar have that tight, waxy texture that we so readily recognize as being cheddar, and really no other cheese shares that texture. And that's because of the cheddaring process, which milling the curd down into little tiny popcorn-size granules and then piling it up physically by hand over and over and over so that all the whey drains out. That's very specific to the making of cheddar.
But now getting back to this paragon of cheddar.
I digress.
I love your digressions. But what about this great American cheddar?
American cheddar is more one-dimensional than Somerset. We judge American cheddar by its sharpness. The problem with American cheddar is that it's such a huge commodity cheese that it's made by enormous factories, mostly in Wisconsin and California, New York State, and then is packaged to be shipped out to supermarkets all over the country, is that it's not old enough. And that's why it's so boring. This is cheddar that's got maximum 3-4 months, rarely 6 months of age. 6 months of age for me, I say, feh, I won't even allow it in my stores at Fairway in New York City because it's not old enough. That's the problem with cheddar in a supermarket. In order to buy the great, sublime, earth-shaking American cheddar, you have to go to specialty stores and ask for specific cheddars by name and be jingoistic about it. If you're from Oregon, by God, buy Tillamook cheddar because it's wonderful, and it's a very small factory, and all of it is handmade. It's always going to be white cheddar, and you'll be able to buy Tillamook that's a year, 2 and sometimes 3 years old, and it's delicious.
That is out there also because I see it in stores around the country as well.
Yeah, you can get Tillamook cheddar readily available, and marvelous stuff.
Okay, what about New York?
New York is all, like Wisconsin, not happening because all of these herds that are in New York State and Wisconsin sell their milk and their milk futures to factories that make cheddar, block cheddar, 40-pound blocks, and process them further into things like American cheese for cheeseburgers and shredded cheddar, young, soapy, tasteless cheddar that's used for tacos, for Taco Bell, and that kind of nonsense. The best cheddars, though, are specific, like the Vermont cheddar from Grafton, which in my opinion is the best cheddar in America. Grafton cheddar is all made by Scott Fleischer, who's my age. He's a little bit younger. I'm 50. He's probably about 48. But he's been doing this since he graduated from high school back in 69. Every day, Scott's been making Grafton Village Vermont cheddar. They use raw milk only. Always they use raw milk. And the cheddar is aged a long, long time. Peter Moen, who runs the Grafton business, sends me Grafton cheddar that's 4 years old. They call Grafton Gold, and it explodes on the palate. The other great Vermont cheddar is Shelburne. I don't think it's the equal to Grafton for the last several years since they lost their great cheesemaker, and they've been trying to get back ever since. Shelburne, though, is very high-end, very artisanal, raw milk American cheddar. Has sort of an adult bitterness that some people find very, very appealing. I sort of like the Grafton better because it doesn't have that bitterness. Both of them white cheddars, both of them made by hand, made from raw milk. And you simply can't find that quality of cheddar made in New York State, nor can you find it made in Wisconsin, except little tiny pockets of artisanal Wisconsin cheddar makers that literally sell it all locally and at green markets.
Steve, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Steve Jenkins is the author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now, Steve hangs out behind the cheese counters at the Fairway Markets in New York City. But his cheese picks are always found on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the controversial Fast Food Nation, an inside look at America's fast food industry, food in the movies, some picks and pans, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. I've got some things for us to think about. We Americans spend more money on fast foods than on higher education, personal computers, computer software, or new cars. And one of the most famous of the fast food chains, McDonald's, is America's largest buyer of beef, pork, and potatoes. And interestingly enough, it's the largest private operator of playgrounds. Well, this information is from a new book. It's called Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. It's by Eric Schlosser. He's an award-winning journalist who writes for national publications like Atlantic Monthly and Rolling Stone. Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
Eric, you cover a lot of territory in this book, but I'd like to talk about what's on our plates. So let's say, for instance, I go to McDonald's and I order a Coke and fries and a burger. So what is the food about? Let's start with the Coke. What's in the Coke?
Well, the Coke is probably the most profitable item sold in American restaurants today.
Huh.
It's essentially water, a little sugar syrup, and that sugar syrup has some coloring agent and a flavoring agent, and then they carbonate the water. But there's only a few pennies worth of sugar syrup in that Coke, and the profit rate is extraordinary. And that's where these restaurants really rake it in.
Mm. That's probably been true for a very, very long time, too, right?
It has been, but they're even more profitable now. One of the striking things about the fast food industry is the change in portion sizes. And if you got a Coke at a McDonald's in the late 50s, it was probably 8 ounces. Now they're selling sodas that are regularly 32 ounces, 40 ounces, and a child-sized Coke at McDonald's now is 12 ounces.
Uh-huh.
When you look at the rise of obesity and certainly among children, the increased soda consumption, it really has to do with the increased portion size.
Okay, let's talk French fries. I mean, that is something just about everybody loves, and I have to tell you, a lot of these fast food chains, they make good fries.
They make really good fries. But I can tell you that in the back of these fast food restaurants, they're not peeling potatoes and cutting them up and then frying them in oil. These French fries come from gigantic French fry factories. And I visited a couple in Idaho, and they're remarkable places. I mean, they produce millions of pounds of perfectly sliced French fries with these highly automated machinery. And freeze them. And so when you're in a fast food restaurant, essentially they're frozen fries that are being reheated. And at McDonald's, the fries just have this extra something, this flavor that you can't quite get a handle on it. And it makes those fries better than just about any other fast food fries. And it comes from a chemical additive that is added at these factories.
What's the chemical additive?
Well, I couldn't quite pin that down.
They didn't welcome you at the door and say, let us tell you our secret.
They didn't hand me over a list of ingredients that pinpointed it. But if you look at the list of ingredients that McDonald's does provide, at the end there's this innocuous phrase, natural flavor. And McDonald's does acknowledge that the natural flavor in its French fries comes from, quote, animal products, unquote. Although they won't say exactly which animal. It's most likely a beef flavoring.
Uh-huh.
But what was interesting to me is it led me to explore this brand new flavor industry that has arisen in this country, mainly in New Jersey, not far from the New Jersey Turnpike, that manufactures flavor additives for most fast food and indeed for most of the processed food that we now eat.
All right, tell me a little bit about this.
Well, when you think about fast food, you have to think about some of the most heavily processed food that's sold in the United States. And the processing techniques, freezing and freeze-drying and dehydrating, that they use have the unfortunate effect of destroying much of the flavor of the food. So this industry, the flavor industry, manufactures these highly complex chemical additives that are put into the food. And when you chew the food or when you drink the drink, it releases an aroma. And that aroma really gives you a sense of what you think you're eating. So in the case of French fries, it's the subtle beef flavoring aroma that reminds you of the days when they used to make their French fries by cooking them in beef tallow.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at chicken McNuggets have beef extract in them. And most fast food has various flavor additives that give you a powerful sense of again, of the food you think you're eating.
But this is true not just in fast food. I mean, this is true in a lot of packaged foods and processed foods, right?
It's true in a remarkable amount of processed food. I mean, it's true in many health foods. It's true if you just look into your kitchen cupboard and start examining the labels. It's remarkable how often you'll find the phrase artificial flavor or natural flavor. And it's not necessarily a dangerous thing, but when it comes to fast food in particular, it's kind of a strange thing, and it's a symbol to me of how different this food is from what you'd make at home and how highly industrialized our whole food system and agricultural production system has become in a very short period of time.
Mm. I'm almost afraid to ask about the burger.
Well, again, the burger looks a lot like a burger that you might have bought 25 years ago at McDonald's or one of these other chains, except it is frozen. It arrives at the restaurant frozen. And it's actually a very different piece of meat. When you got a hamburger 25 years ago in America, it most likely came from a small regional processing plant or came from the back of a butcher shop. And so most likely there were pieces of one animal in that one burger. When you get a fast food burger today, there are pieces of dozens, if not hundreds, of cattle in that one hamburger, because ground beef is now produced in gigantic hamburger factories in Colorado and Nebraska and Texas that grind thousands and thousands of animals together into these gigantic vats of ground beef. And that has real important consequences in terms of the spread of various foodborne pathogens like E. coli, O157, H7. These gigantic grinders that make up to 1 million pounds of hamburger a day are just a perfect way to spread diseases far and wide, really before anyone has any idea that these pathogens have been introduced into the meat.
But wait a minute. We've got the USDA and we have the FDA, who supposedly are assuring us that our food is safe.
Well, that's one of the problems. You've got the USDA and the FDA and almost a dozen other federal agencies that are looking after food safety with very separate responsibilities and oversight. And as a result, a lot falls through the cracks. What we really need is one food safety agency with real power to protect the public health. The USDA has responsibility for meat. And yet the federal government today has no power to order the recall of contaminated meat. I mean, we can order the recall of a toy that might cause a choking hazard to a child or a stuffed animal that's defective, but the federal government cannot order the recall of tons of contaminated meat that could make thousands of people sick. And that's really a sign of how powerful and influential the meatpacking industry has been for decades in this country.
Hmm. Eric, after doing this book, do you still eat fast food?
I don't eat fast food. There's one fast food chain in California called In-N-Out Burger that really is behaving ethically and I think treats its workers well and doesn't sell this heavily processed food. But I don't buy from the major chains, not because I think I'm going to get food poisoning, but because I'm very angry about some of their business practices. So there's a moratorium in our family for fast food consumption at the moment.
Well, Eric, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take a double cheeseburger and an order of fries. With every bite, blood pressure rise. Fast food woman put the food in the slot. Shred register and win a free burial plot. Fast food, slow death.
Well, that about says it. Eric Schlosser is author of Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. It's Academy Awards time. And once again, a movie with food as a prominent player is up for the prizes. Chocolat is up for Best Picture, and its lead is nominated for Best Actress. Could this be just because of those scenes of Juliette Binoche stirring thick, dark chocolate? I mean, is the chocolate the star here? Well, we're turning to our movie maven, Stephanie Curtis. Stephanie, thanks for coming by.
It's great to be here.
Okay, let's talk the Academy Awards.
I'm ready.
You're our movie maven, and we've seen this whole trend of food in the movies. I mean, Chocolat is up for Picture of the Year and Best Actress. So tell me, you know, what is this about food in the movies? Is it a nice way to get around lousy acting?
It is not, because there are food films with lousy acting in them that they just fall to pieces anyway. I think the great thing about food in film is that it's such a sensuous experience in people's lives, and they can really and there's a wonderful process you can follow too of cooking, and then the enjoyment. So it's like a great movie, you know, follows a plot line through, and great food. You start out making the food,
mm-hmm.
you hand it off to people. It's the enjoyment of the meal, and it's such a huge part of people's lives. And I think a lot of people fantasize about wonderful, perfect meals, and so what better place to have them than in the movies?
Well, let's look at the trend. What's come out over the past couple of years that you think really shows, you know, what's going on with food and film?
Well, I think the first one that really went crazy, where people started thinking, you know, maybe there's something here. Maybe people really want to see more food in film, was Babette's Feast. And that was in the late 80s. And then since then, we've had a lot of films that have done really, really well, like Water for Chocolate. At the time, it was a Mexican movie about a really talented chef. And at the time, it was the number two foreign film of all time. You know, people
mm-hmm,
flocked to
mm-hmm.
it. And then Eat, Drink, Man, Woman by Ang Lee, who has a film that's up for Best Picture this year. Also, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon did very, very well for it. You know, a small Taiwanese film, and people just flocked to it. And then Big Night from a couple of years ago did very, very well. And I think people realized, the filmmakers thought, people like seeing food on film. They like seeing cooking.
Yeah,
and since
yeah.
then, we've not only had great films like Chocolat, but we've had some lousy films or films that, you know, parade themselves up as being a food film when they really aren't.
So what are the stinkers?
Oh, the stinkers. There's one starring called Simply Irresistible. By no one saw it. I went to see it. I don't know what possessed
me. There were four people in the theater.
There were four people in the theater. And it's starring Sarah Michelle Gellar, who's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And she inherits a restaurant.
A great talent if there ever was one.
She inherits a restaurant, and she discovers a magical ability to make food that makes people fall in love. So they were trying to tap into, like, Water for Chocolate, and the whole trend about, you know, like Water for Chocolate, the chef's emotions get poured into the food, and people get overwhelmed by her sadness or her desire for a man that she's thinking
yeah,
of.
But I mean, like Water for Chocolate, the book was sheer poetry. I mean, we're talking about a really incredible foundation
and
here.
And so was the movie. But someone thought, you know what I bet it is? It's just that magic food, and women like seeing romance. So let's just have Sarah Michelle Gellar go into a movie. She'll make some food. But it really doesn't come across. They don't seem to understand what food making is about. And it avoided at all costs, is what I have to say.
Okay, what about, got a big play, Penelope Cruz, Woman on Top. She's a chef, right?
She's a chef. And she is a Brazilian chef that makes really spicy food. And she comes to the U.S. to escape a heartbreaking romance, the broken marriage.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what goes wrong with a food movie when they, you know, they want to show the passion involved in food and how sensuous it is. But instead, they fall back on a lot of close-up shots of Penelope Cruz sniffing chilies with her lip quivering.
Basic food porn, but with nothing to back it up.
Exactly.
Okay, I've got it.
It just doesn't come through. You don't get the idea they understand anything about food, and it seems like a gimmick.
So, Stephanie, you think Chocolat is going to win?
There's no way. There's just no way. Chocolat has been getting a lot of bad press lately. And while it's been doing well at the box office, people mm-hmm. love it. I think people are telling other people, you got to go see this. The scenes with chocolate, the romance, the beauty of the movie is incredible. It's a real crowd pleaser. But one, it's getting, I think it's seen as a little bit too sweet and small of a movie to be considered a best picture.
Right.
Plus, It's made by a company called Miramax. And Miramax does these hard sellings of movies every year for their best picture. They choose one last year. They put advertising. They go after the Academy members and just try to sell them on a single movie. Last year was Cider House Rules. Mm-hmm. This year it is Chocolat. And they have won before with Shakespeare in Love. These are all great movies. But I think that the industry is kind of tired of Miramax shoving films down their throat. And even if people are going to Chocolat and really loving it, I don't think it's going to be the winner.
Well, Stephanie, I'm going to hold you to this one. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for inviting me.
Stephanie Curtis is a producer for American Radio Works. Now, when you sit down to watch the Oscars, I want you to think of me. Forget the chips and dip. I have come up with a TV tray dinner for you. Think Aaron Brockovich cooks for the Gladiator. This is really my killer mac and cheese. Trust me, Roman gladiators would have died for this one. We're literal here. And for a little counterpoint, we have Traffic's Tijuana coleslaw. Some shredded chilies and a crunchy, tangy slaw qualify here. Of course, Chocolat takes the dessert course. Then, as the awards edge toward midnight and you get the munchies, cozy up with a bowl of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon popcorn. So, check out the menu on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our trivia question of the week. It's about food in the movies. Now, you heard the answer to this not too long ago during an interview right here on the Splendid Table. The question is, back in the days of silent films, what was the secret formula of the pies thrown by the comics? We're going to be back in a moment with that answer and your calls. The lines are going to be opening. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252, and, well, we'll try to answer just about any question you come up with. I'm not saying we're going to get it right. But before I get back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It's about food in the movies, and you actually heard the answer right here on the show. It was during an interview not too long ago. Well, the question was, back in the days of silent films, what was the secret formula of those pies that the comics used to throw at each other? Now, Max Sennett was the genius behind hurling pies in those old Keystone Cop silent films. Alan Ridenour, who wrote a book called Offbeat Food, told us that Sennett came up with a special formula. He had Hollywood pie bakers make the pies extra sloppy by using gloppy wheat paste topped with whipped cream. Now, if the pies were aimed at blondes, Sennett made sure dark berries were added to the mix for better contrast. Now, Laurel and Hardy grabbed the idea, and in one of their movies called Battle of the Century, a pie fight begins with a single pastry being lobbed at Oliver Hardy. By the time the scene goes to dark, an entire city block is packed with people propelling pies at each other. A total of 3,000 pies were used to shoot this scene. I just wonder how many retakes there were. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, we have Kristen on the line. So, Kristen, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm calling because every year my wife and I have a romantic dinner at home on Valentine's Day.
Uh-huh.
And we get a couple of live lobsters that are the featured course of our meal. And every year, we're left with remnants, you know, both the water that the lobster was cooked in, and then, of course, the parts of the lobster that we don't consume. What could we do with these things that are left over? Are there any creative things, bisques, perhaps, something along those lines?
You're telling me that after a romantic Valentine's dinner, eating luscious lobster with your fingers, you're worrying about what to do with the leftovers?
Okay, maybe it's the day after.
This I can believe. Okay, well, there's a lot you can do, and considering what you're probably paying for those lobsters, you know, this is handy stuff to know. As far as the liquid the lobsters are cooked in, and the shells, as a matter of fact, they've got to be chilled right away. You know, and again, I don't know if you are doing that right away.
Okay.
You may be preoccupied, but they spoil so quickly. Okay. But what you can do is, you're right, you can make a bisque, you can make a broth. What you can do is make a broth that you freeze, and then you have it to do sauces, to make a soup, or whatever. And one of the things the French have been doing with lobster shells for probably hundreds of years is that you take the shells. You can crack them up if you want. They're probably already broken up anyway because of the way you've eaten the lobster. Put some nice, good unsalted butter in a big saute pan. Add the shells and some cut up celery, carrot, and onion and garlic, and saute them.
Okay.
And once you get those vegetables that they start to turn golden, and it's going to be very aromatic, you can add a little bit of brandy to that. Just, you know, a quarter of a cup or something. Boil that down, and then add white wine, like a whole cup, and boil that down. And then throw in a little bit of tomato and water to cover and simmer it about 30 minutes.
When you said butter initially, right?
Yep.
How much butter would you use?
You could use olive oil, too, but I'd use like 2 or 3 tablespoons, even a little more. You want to be generous. And then you can add whatever seasonings you like, you know, what herbs you think you'd enjoy. And the idea is, now you've made this sort of broth that's going to have a lot of flavor to it. Now you can use that as a base for any kind of seafood soup. You could add cream to it. It's utterly delicious. You know, you could add cooked or uncooked seafood to it, and it'll be wonderful. And if the water you cook the lobster in has a lot of flavor, that could go into the pot too. The other thing you can do with it is thicken it with a mixture of flour and butter. Just simmer that in when you want to make a sauce, and add a little cream.
That's just the liquid.
That's right. Yep. And you're home free. So the shells are going to give you an awful lot of flavor. So there's your basic, classic, very fancy, very good sauce with leftover lobster.
Good.
Now, what you can do with the aftermath of the rest of the evening, that's up to you guys.
Okay. We're doing all right now.
It sounds like a super way to celebrate Valentine's Day.
It is. It's turned out we've been doing it for 8 years now.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. And this is the first year that we've done it as a married couple.
Oh, that's even more encouraging. I'm wondering.
It seems to be working out pretty well.
All right. So the trick to successful romance and a good marriage is have lobster together on Valentine's Day.
I can solidly recommend.
Okay, Kristen. Hey, happy Valentine's Day to you both. A belated happy Valentine's
Day. Thanks a lot, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We're open to just about anything here at the Splendid Table. Okay, let's see. Who's been waiting patiently? We've got Vince on the line. Vince, what's in your mind?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am swell.
Well, I wished I was.
Why? What's the matter?
Well, I have a radio talk show in Ambridge, Pennsylvania, WMBA.
Uh-huh.
And I try to talk about food all the time. And people keep calling and talking about politics. And I'm a retired chef, and, you know, I know about as much about politics as I do what I get out of the paper, you know.
Right.
And they keep calling. You know, apparently I am able to answer them because they haven't gotten, you know, nobody's hung up on me. I've had to hang up on a couple of them. But I want to talk about food. I want to talk about wine. I want to talk about cheese. I want to talk about cigars. I want to talk about music. You know, the sensual things in your life. And these people want to talk about politics all the time. What do I do?
Well, yeah, but now you have to admit, what's been going on in politics over the past 6 months has not been boring or tedious.
No, it hasn't. But, I mean, I'm there to do a job. And I can't do my job unless I get cooperation from the callers.
Well, you know, the one thing you could think about, considering what's going on in the White House right now, is maybe ask their opinions about how people eat in Texas.
Okay.
You know, like, for instance, is anybody in Texas testing people on their chili acumen? Along with everything else. I would say connect it to politics in every way you can. What is Bill Clinton going to be eating while he's up in Harlem in that new office building?
I have no idea.
Well,
what
you know,
eating.
God willing, he's going to eat well when he's up there.
That's for sure.
I sympathize with you, Vince, especially when you're hungry for this kind of thing and considering your background. But it also sounds like you have a good time.
I have a good time, but, you know, it's just it's frustrating. Some people do call and talk about food. But some people just want to talk about politics. Yes. You know, I'm getting to the point now where I'm starting to hang up on people, and I really don't want to do that because that's not my personality. You know?
Yeah, I can hear that. I can hear that. But you know what? I wonder, there's another aspect to this. What about the politics of food?
Yeah.
We got a lot of issues out there that are really interesting these days. Maybe steer them in that direction.
Okay.
And call us. We love to talk to you about food.
I'll make it a point.
Dynamite, Vince. Hey, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we like to talk about the politics of food. Lucy's on the line. So, Lucy, what's stirring? What challenging? What controversial topic would you like to talk about today?
Oh, hi, Lynn. I don't know if it's controversial, but I would say it's probably interesting. I hope so for you. But on a recent trip to Lisbon, my husband and I had a marvelous Moroccan food at a restaurant, and I noticed the restaurant served everything in beautiful tagines, you know, very bright and colorful. I've never seen them before. I tried to get the restaurant to sell me a couple, but they wouldn't. And then I came back to the States, and I had a very hard time finding tagines, and then I finally found one, and it is beautiful. And I was wondering, can you use it on the top of the stove and in the oven, or will it break?
What this is one of the ways in Morocco that you cook stews and braised dishes and even roasted things, really. It's as you know, it's a shallow, thick, heavy, glazed ceramic base, rather like a flower pot saucer, but thicker, thicker pottery. And then it's topped by this tall cone of a lid, also made out of ceramic, right?
Right.
So you did find one here.
Right.
Because I know there's a couple of places I've run in that sell them here. There's this great place in Salt Lake City called, I think it's the Cheese House, that is bringing them in. It's a dynamite place. And I think it's also in something like Sur La Table's catalog.
Oh, that's great, because I wanted to buy more of different patterns.
Yeah, you can call the Cheese House in Salt Lake City. I don't know if they have a catalog, but Sur La Table is a mail order house.
Okay.
And they have a ton of stuff. So you're saying you want to know how to cook in that tagine?
Right, because I bought one that I think is like decorative and all that. I would like not to have it crack on me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that you can use it on the stove and in the oven, or do I need to buy a diffuser for that bottom part that looks like the flower pot saucer?
All the answer to everything, all the above is yes.
Okay.
No, but here's the thing. Here's the thing. With any glazed pottery that you're going to use on top of the stove, and in Morocco, people don't have ovens as much as they just cook over a charcoal brazier.
Okay.
The trick is you do need a diffuser, and that's that a diffuser is usually two round discs of metal that are joined by little extensions, you know, and they have holes in them. And you put them on the burner, and then you put your pot on top of that, and it keeps the heat very gentle.
So that will protect my tagine.
That's right. The other thing is, always put your tagine on the stove with the heat turned off and start with very, very low heat.
Okay.
And bring it up and never cook over high heat because it'll crack.
Okay. Now, is that the same as in the oven? Always, like, bring it up from, like, 250
yeah.
or 300?
I'd say put it in a cold oven and bring it up gently.
Okay, put it in a cold yep. and bring it up gently.
But there's also, you have to season ceramic.
Okay.
This kind of pot. And what they do in Morocco is so fascinating. I've been a fan of Moroccan food since the 1970s when Paula Wolfert came out with her book. I think it was called Couscous and Other Good Food from Morocco. But the deal is that you want to get rid of the earthenware taste that's going to come in this kind of ceramic stuff. And you want to clean it. And you
right.
want to sort of season it. You want to prepare it for food. So what you do is you wash it really well inside and out with soap and water.
Okay.
And then you put into it a big onion that you slice up.
Okay.
A couple of carrots that you slice up. About 5 or 6 cloves of garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of bay leaves. And then water that comes up to within a half inch of the rim of the base of the tagine.
Okay.
Okay? You cover it and you put it in the oven and you turn the heat on to about 300 degrees and you leave it there for about 50 minutes.
Okay.
Turn off the heat. Let it cool completely in the oven, then empty it and wash it, and it's ready to go.
Oh, but covered with the cone on it?
Mm-hmm, because you're
okay.
steaming the cone, too.
Right.
This
okay,
is gonna,
I just want to make sure.
Right. The vegetables should be tender, and then you toss them so it's away, you wash it, and then it's ready to go.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
And I love your book.
Well, thank you, and I love the idea you went out and bought this. This is great. Enjoy it. You're going to love it.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
By the way, guys, you should know one thing, that the pot that we're describing with this tall conical lid is called a tagine, and so are the dishes you make in it. They're called tagines. And if you look in Moroccan cookbooks, you'll find a ton of recipes. Slow cooked, flavors melting into each other. What a way to live. Oh, gosh. And you can make them ahead. We have Sandy on the line. So, Sandy, what's on your mind?
My husband would like to know how to make fresh cranberry juice. And he's bought the cranberries, we've run them through a food processor, a juicer, a chinoir, and he doesn't get, oh, and he tried to boil them. He's not getting what he's looking for.
Sounds like he's beating the you-know-what out of these poor innocent berries.
Well, they're not that hard. They're kind of hard to beat, actually. They're pretty tough berries.
Well, they really are. They are. Well, so the food processor approach didn't work, I gather. Not enough juice.
It looked like pulp.
And that's exactly what it is. This is one way. One way you do this is by actually cooking them.
Okay.
So you do sort of equal parts of water to cranberry, and you cook them until they pop. You know how you'd make cranberry sauce?
Yes, he can do that.
Well, if he can do that, if he uses a lot of water, so if he's got 2 cups of cranberries, he uses 2 cups of water.
Okay.
And he boils that until the cranberries pop, and then you strain it, really press it as much as you can, you know, like through a food mill.
Okay, well, we have a chinois, which I guess.
Oh, yeah, you can use a chinois. You can use, that's that very, very fine conical-shaped
yes,
sieve. It looks like a Chinese hat, hence the name.
Yeah.
Yes, you could do that and press as much as you can to get most of the juice out. But it takes a lot of cranberries to make cranberry juice.
I thought so.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of depressing, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
I think you should keep just buying the juice. But he's kind of determined now to figure out how to do it.
I know. We get like that, don't we? But I would say you need a large quantity of cranberries. You need the water. Generally, it's the cooking process.
So how long are they being cooked for? Maybe you didn't cook them long enough.
15 minutes.
Okay.
You know, until you see the skins pop.
Okay.
Now, another way is people do put them in a juicer and juice them.
They came out pulpy that way, too.
Well, he wants clear juice, huh?
Yeah.
Then he's going to have to water it down and dilute it to get that.
Okay.
That's the key. Because, you know, it's
It's very pulpy. It's like trying to get strawberry juice.
Okay.
But that pulp is good. It's fiber.
Yeah.
I know he doesn't want to hear that.
Well, the good thing is he doesn't like to buy the store brands because they're too sweet. He likes the bitter taste of the cranberry.
Well, this will give him that pure taste, and then he can add sugar if he wants to, but he doesn't have to. And I agree with him. I don't want sugar in it. I really want it straight.
Okay.
You know, he may be able to find it straight. I'm trying to think. There are some organic packers.
He does. He buys it.
He does.
But
okay.
He's, like I said, he's still determined.
I understand this determination. Wish him good luck and tell him water is the key and some boiling.
Okay.
Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you, Lynn.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. You know, it's kind of odd when you think about it that a man is this obsessed with cranberry juice, because usually it's women who are obsessed with cranberry juice. Well, I think it's really about conquering something. Men get like that when it comes to cooking. Well, everybody, that's the show for this week. Hey, thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with a comment from A. Whitney Brown. He said, "I'm not a vegetarian because I love animals. I'm a vegetarian because I hate plants." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where you'll find an exclusive selection of Corningware bakeware, including the classic French white line. Corningware can go from the freezer to the oven to the dinner table. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That's splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is composed by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.